February 24th marked the one-year anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Some still blame the expansion of NATO in Russia's neighbourhood as a deeper cause of this war. Others see it as Putin's personal mad plan to go down in the history books. But some are pointing the finger to something much deeper than any of that. The Russian soul. A concept that originated in Russia's literary tradition of Dostoevsky, Tolstoy and other great authors is seen as animating today's national exceptionalism, which in turn is fueling Putin's speeches. But how straightforward is it to draw a causal link between a country's cultural past and the politics of today? Is it really ideas that animate history, or should we look to material conditions for a better explanation of events? Welcome to The Philosopher and the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. This week, I welcome to the podcast Josephine von Sitzewitz. She is a lecturer in Russian at the University of Oxford and recently wrote an article entitled The Uses and Abuses of the Russian Soul, The Weaponization of Russian Identity, in which she explores the limits of the idea that Russian culture and literature have a role to play in the war against Ukraine. Josephine von Sitzewitz, welcome to The Philosopher and the News.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So I wanted to talk to you about this article that you wrote recently for the Institute of Art and Ideas on the Russian soul. And I wanted to start by discussing a bit this sort of naive appeal that the concept maybe has towards students of Russian literature and Russian culture and Russian history. What is it about this concept that has a sort of mysterious allure to young students?
I think, like terms such as romantic or realist, there is a strictly scientific or scholarly use of it, and then you have the more popular one. And for example, if you look at translations of Dostoevsky's novel, you will see that he is often praised as an expert in the Russian soul. And I'm quite sure that those editors who write the blurbs are not actually talking about any idea of Russian national exceptionalism, but they are talking about this melancholy. They're also talking about the generosity, and I think they're talking about the duality that you can find in many 19th century novels. The duality that makes, for example, Dostoevsky's hero, Dmitry Karamazov, one of the characters in The Brothers Karamazov, who's accused of killing his father, and we see that he is capable of the most extraordinary acts of kindness, but he's also led by his emotions, and he is also prone to melancholy, and we can absolutely imagine why people would suspect him of killing his father. Turns out that's not actually what he did. But there is a link between this popular concept, and the popular concept usually comes as the enigmatic Russian soul, Zagadochnaya Ruskaya Dusha. There is a link between this popular concept and the more perhaps scholarly or historical or philosophical one. Because that duality, this idea that there are two sides to the Russian national character, I think that is definitely something that we can find in this idea of the Russian national exceptionalism, that Russia is at once Western and Eastern. Russia is at once pagan and wild, but also very religious and orthodox and conservative. Russia has the Western cultural heritage that was introduced by Peter the First, which is probably where we should start. But it also has Eastern Orthodoxy, and it has, of course, that Asian part of it. And even if you look at geography, it is actually sitting in between Europe and Asia, it is both Europe and Asia, and actually the modern, modern perhaps is the wrong word, but the iteration of Eurasianism that we can hear from people like Alexander Dugin, that slightly crazy philosopher. That's all from there.
Before we go into that side of it, which is like sort of more political or historical side, what are, can we talk a little bit more about these kind of literary origins of the concept? You mentioned Dostoevsky, in your piece you also mentioned Tolstoy, Turgenev, this sort of exploration of the depth of the national or Russian character and the Russian soul. What is it? What are the origins of this idea? What are the, why did people start talking about that or thinking about that?
I think it's a typical 19th century European European phenomenon that many countries at the time were trying to formulate ethno-national identities. Right. And the idea actually of a soul or a spirit that reunites, that unites a whole people is probably German. Somebody will say no, somebody else had it before them, but I know it as a German concept in Hegel and in others. And because so much of that material came over to Russia, I think it is a mixture of that vocabulary from philosophy. And then ideas that Russia was actually separate from the West. So you can once again see that duality. So in the mid 1800s, in the mid 19th century, when Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Turgenev, and so on were writing, there was a debate raging really in Russian literature and in journals as well. And perhaps at this point we should say that in Russia, literature was always the forum for sociopolitical debate. That that I think explains also the centrality of literature to this idea. And should Russia modernize in a Western way? Should Russia adopt Western means of governance? Should Russia actually follow this? Should Russia follow rational ideas? Should Russia follow socialist ideas, perhaps? Or does Russia have an identity of its own? And there were people who were very convinced that Russia has an identity of its own. So it was from the very beginning, pitted against rationalism, against Western models. And so where do you link it back to? You link it back to orthodoxy. You link it back to a myth, and there is the mythology, to the mythological depth in the simple Russian people, the ordinary Russian people, the Russian peasants. So the idea that you can say and see in Tyutchev's, for example, poetry, and certainly also in Dostoevsky, of the Russian people as God bearers. So the Russian people have something Christ-like, and they are bringing. So there is the link to suffering. So the Russian people are suffering, and their suffering brings some kind of salvation. So it comes with a link to the Russian soil, and it comes with an idea of a different Slavonic identity. They were called the Slavophiles, and later, native soil, the native soil movement. So it was from the beginning directed against the influence of Western ideas.
Yeah, interesting. And I guess we're kind of, in some ways, witnessing this very conscious turn away from the West now by Putin, kind of cutting down any ties and sort of ending a kind of maybe impression that Russia was going to become more more Western and more European. And now I think that project looks like it's definitely over. You mentioned a few things there, sort of anti-Western in the sense of being against rationality or having a sort of different sense of identity that's more tied to the religious past. What else could we say about how Russia views itself in world history and in connection to what's going on in Europe, and as sort of developing a sort of separate culture and a separate identity to the European one.
We perhaps need to take in the idea of the Russian Empire, and this is a religious idea. So again, many, many factors influence all this. The idea of Moscow as the third Rome, i.e. the Russian Empire, or whatever preceded the Russian Empire, the empire is the creation of Peter the First, really, Peter the Great, as the successor, because it kept orthodoxy. So first there was Rome, and there was no split between the Western and Eastern Church. Then there was Byzantium, which became Muslim. And so orthodoxy was under threat from there. And then Moscow became Orthodox, chose the Orthodox religion in the early hours, really, of the millennium. And so there is a very strong notion that it is Russia, it is the patriarchy, and that upholds orthodoxy, the right form of Christianity. So that is a strong historical, philosophical, political underpinning that people may not actually be aware of. But of course, that religious idea is very strong, and the Orthodox Church never underwent a reformation, and Russia didn't have a Renaissance, and Russia had an Enlightenment, but the Enlightenment was imported from Europe. So all the, if you want to say, natural onslaughts against the primacy of religion in political and in public life, they didn't happen in Russia. So they only came in the 19th century as, and I'm simplifying, of course, here, but they came in the 19th century in connection with the adoption of ideas by Feuerbach, by Marx, so the whole the German philosophical, radical philosophical tradition, which was taken much more literally in Russia and much more radically. And of course, can I add to that Peter the Great, with his reforms, so he actually disliked the primacy of the Orthodox Church, and what he did, one of his reforms in the late 17th century, was to actually replace the authority of the Patriarch with a Holy Synod, and the Synod had a secular procurator at the top. So the Orthodox Church was turned into a subject of the Emperor. And that's had terrible consequences, of course, for the Orthodox Church. But it also led to Peter being accused of having brought the downfall of holy Russia.
Interesting that you mentioned that. I mean, some of the ideological influences here are German philosophers. You mentioned Feuerbach. We have a sort of undertone of a kind of anti-Enlightenment thought. You said Russia did go through an Enlightenment, but to me it seems a lot of these sort of concepts that you mentioned, this sort of like, you know, blood and soil type ideas, come from sort of more anti-Enlightenment figures in German philosophy. But then on the popular level, you have this idea that you say in your piece, there's this anecdote of like, what is good for a Russian will kill a German, and Germans are seen as the sort of Western other. So sort of interesting kind of contradiction there, almost, or tension between the kind of understanding at the kind of high level, high cultural level, and then at a more kind of popular level.
Absolutely. And you have again, there is a contradiction. And I think the problem, if you try to work with this concept, is that it is utterly contradictory and has this duality in it. I mean, Germans are the cultural other. Catherine the Great, who who is the person who really wanted to further the Enlightenment in Russia. She invited lots of Germans German tradesmen and Germans who knew advanced farming techniques. That's where the Volga Germans come from. And then, so the cliche of the Russified German, Abrusievshi Niemiec, that is a mainstay. So the Germans were from that very early age, where the other. Mm. And funnily enough, the word Niemiec, Niemoy, is a Russian adjective that means dumb, i.e. Without language, because you can't understand their language. Mm. So it really is, even on a linguistic level, it's the quintessential other. It's the person not of our language. Mm. And of course, Germans are very rational. Germans are very organized. Germans are very this, very that. If you look at Pushkin's Queen of Spades, of his little novella, there you have a German who is fighting his nature, and he's a very organized and very rational man, but he's also a gambler. Mm. So yes, and on the popular level, of course, there are other jokes. Everybody puts their seatbelt on in the car because they think, oh, what if I end up in a car crash? And only Russians think, what if the police comes?
Right.
It's that kind of, we don't care about car crashes, come on.
Right.
So I did with my students, we did my translation students, we looked at anecdotes and jokes that were released for the Day of the Russian Language, and how the Russian language is unique, and how a foreigner will never get this. And it's like, okay guys, do you get it? What's going on here? So it is a and on that level it is quite harmless.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, it has that link to something that's much more sinister. Yeah.
So how clearly can you identify the sort of lineage between that sort of, kind of literary tradition, philosophical tradition that talks about or tries to understand the Russian history and Russian soul and Russian heritage as sort of like somewhat other than the Western? And Do you see that? Can you identify it in Putin's speeches today about the war in Ukraine and the kind of ideology that he brings up?
Very, very clearly. So first of all, I said in my piece, stripped of all poetic connotations. So I like my way of putting it, so I'll use that again. So let's strip the Russian soul of everything that's cute and of everything that's fluffy, and then we have a simple myth of national exceptionalism, nothing else. And lots of European peoples have gone through it, most notably Germany, and they were disabused of that by violence and by force and at horrific cost for the whole of Europe. Of course, Russia's never had that defeat, but maybe we can come back to that later. Mm. But what is definitely there, so when the Soviet Union was, when the Bolsheviks tried to further a national self-understanding, or not a national self-understanding, but an identity that was, at least at the beginning, very much internationalist. Communism will sweep Europe. And Germany is actually the first country that will become where communist revolution will happen. And then it didn't happen. And so all of a sudden, that contradiction of socialism in one country, needed to be lived with. But one of the things that it didn't do, while Russia was, of course, the central, Russia was the seat of power in the Soviet Union. Moscow was the capital. Russian was the main language spoken, and also at various times, there was a quite aggressive policy of Russification going on, of the Baltic states, for example. But if we leave that aside, then during the Soviet times, especially in the later decades, Russian national identity, especially tied up with orthodoxy, was very much a force of opposition. Because Soviet internationalism, so Soviet Russian national identity, if you read Solzhenitsyn, you know, Solzhenitsyn, because he was exiled, because he was the arch enemy, he became the arch enemy of the Soviet of the Soviet authorities. They stripped him of his citizenship and threw him out the country.
Can you remind people who Solzhenitsyn was?
Yes, he was the man who wrote the Gulag Archipelago. So he was a writer in the second half of the 20th century. He himself was imprisoned in the Gulag. Most of its work could not be published. He was a dissident. He was part of the 1960s dissident movements, and then he wrote. He collected and collated all these testimonies that actually. Revealed, if you want, the sheer size of the camp system in the Soviet Union, and he called the whole Soviet Union basically an archipelago of camps. And he was exiled by force, like many intellectuals. And because he lived in America, and because he was so vociferous. And because his stuff was published, his writings were published in the West, people think, oh, he was a friend of, you know, he wanted to reform. Hmm. You know, he must be the enemy of the Soviet regime must be a friend of the West. No, he wasn't. He was a Russian nationalist and a monarchist. He would have been horrified at many of the things. He was an arch conservative. And so that identity was there all the way through, but of course during the Soviet Union it was suppressed. It lived underground, and it became it was something altogether different. So after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when it was possible to speak openly, religion came back. Putin declared Orthodoxy the state religion. The massive church in the center of Moscow that was blown up by the Bolsheviks was brought back. The KGB agents who used to persecute believers now get themselves filmed taking communion. So, you know, whenever you abolish one ideology, something comes in there. Something rushes in to fill the void. And there was a ready-made thing there that had never been eradicated. Mm-hmm. I would think that is one of the continuities. And yes, nowadays, Russia has a special path. Russia's following a special path, is there in all the speeches. If you follow Dmitry Medvedev, that is, he is at the moment chairman of Russia's Security Council. He used to be very briefly president when Putin had to take a hiatus. Mm-hmm. Then he was the prime minister. He has become a very crude propaganda mouthpiece. And if you follow him on Telegram, you get it every single day. And Russia stands against the West. And now it is mostly gender ideology. When Putin gave the speech about the annexation of four regions in Ukraine, Donetsk, Lugansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson, none of which Russia completely controls. The speech is available in English on the Kremlin website. He bursts into a diatribe about the West and where they think that they're genders other than male and female, and where you can choose, and where everybody has surgery, and so the West as the West as a threat to morality.
As decadent, yeah.
Ad decadent. It used to be atheism, and now it is something else. Now
LGBT
it is wokeness.
Right, yeah.
LGBT right, and you can see that in many conservative, we shouldn't be complacent. It is there. I mean, the United States have a huge problem with this, but it is also especially the European right. Mm. In Hungary and Poland, who have taken LGBT rights and reproduction rights as their key target and as a token of identity that is other than, I think.
Yeah. I mean, someone might say, someone who's like trying to be sympathetic to this kind of like cultural tradition, or, you know, wants to say well, look, you know, politics is always a dirty business, and, you know, politicians say and do all sorts of things to get what they want. Putin is just weaponizing these ideas for his political gains. You know, this doesn't prove that somehow what's really animating his vision is this ideal of a Russian kind of identity, a Russian soul. But you say in your piece, well, as much as some of us would like it to kind of be able to separate the sort of grubby world of politics from what we see as culture and high culture and literature and philosophy and all those things, separating them isn't really possible. Why isn't it possible to separate the two?
Well, I mean, to start with, I don't know what animates Putin, and I don't care. He is a small-time gangster, but he is also a man who is formed by the Russian security services, and I think his style of politics is evidence to that. I don't know whether he seriously believes in a special national character, or whether all he wants is power for himself, or whether he's completely mad and paranoid. But certainly, if a politician wants to win the support, if he wants to win the support of the people, he needs to present them a vision. And I think we saw it very well in this country with Brexit, where those who were advocating for Brexit were able to present a very interesting vision of Britain that convinced a lot of people who may not actually have shared the vision in its entirety. And so Russia is somehow special, and the West has always been out to get it. That is something that resonates with very, very, very many people. So that is, in that sense, it's actually a very clever element, if you want, cultural element to use, because it is there, and it has been nurtured by centuries of literature, culture, philosophy, debate, and it has popular iterations. It has conspiratorial or conspiratorial iterations, if we look at somebody like Dugin. And these extreme right people from the extreme right, Zakhar Prilepin, then we can actually find it. So it is definitely something that is known and attractive to people. So in that sense, we can see that Putin is actually exploiting it to maximum effect. And it wouldn't work if that vision wasn't shared by people in some way or other.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what got me thinking about this topic in the first place, and the reason I reached out to you, was that I listened to this interview with a Russian soldier in the New York Times, who was saying that, you know, he went to Ukraine kind of thinking that, you know, they were going there for a kind of military exercise or something relatively benign, and then quickly realized this wasn't the case, that this was actually, you know, military combat. I think in this case they were told that this was some kind of exercise by their superiors, and realized, you know, they were woefully unprepared. They, you know, in the few first weeks, were met by, you know, a lot more force by the Ukrainian side than they had anticipated, and then quickly sort of stopped believing in the narrative that he had almost sort of taken for at face value, that, you know, this was nothing too serious, you know, we were going into Ukraine. Then his friends started dying, his friend's soldiers started dying in battle, he himself got really injured and ended up in hospital. And he sort of, his whole view of what they were doing was demystified. He says, I think in that interview, Putin lied to us. You know, this is a war. There's no, I don't know why we're there. There's no kind of, the purpose of it was sort of unclear to him. But then when the interviewer asks him, what are you going to do? And he says, oh, I'm going to go back to the battlefield. And then he says something to the extent of, this is our fate. We've been brought up this way. This is a sort of, you know, our destiny in some way. And this is what reminded me of that kind of Dostoevsky quote about sort of, you know, suffering is the sort of ultimate meaning of Russians or something along those lines. So to bring it back to the conversation about the kind of influence of culture, both at a higher level and a lower level. In your piece, you mention this Ukrainian writer. Probably will mispronounce her name.
Oksana Zabushko. Okay,
thank you. Who makes the claim that Russian literature and Russians themselves, who have kind of like accepted this fate of being sent to war in their thousands and sacrificed as kind of cannon fodder, these are instrumental to the ongoing of war. So it is the culture that is animating it, both ideologically, but also in some sense politically, because people just are not willing to question or resist, as it were, orders from above. What do you make of all this? So, is this line convincing?
As always, and this is of course boring if somebody expects me to say yes or no. As always, it's more complicated than that. So, for example, when Dostoevsky talks about suffering, he of course means Christian suffering. He means redemptive suffering. He means that you have to, if you have violated the moral law, if you have committed murder, for example, then you have to atone. And I think it's fair here to use heavy religious language because that's how he means it. Then you have to atone for that through suffering. And also something that, of course, Christianity has been criticized for throughout the ages, but I personally think there's a very deep truth to it, that it is actually suffering that opens the heart. It is suffering that leads to compassion. It leads suffering in some sense that an overcoming suffering that leads to growth. And so that, you know, if to turn this into something less religious, I think we grow in our dark hours, not in our happy hours, because we don't have to change. We don't have to question ourselves when everything's going swimmingly. So I think that's of course one thing. The culture of passivity that you allude to, yes, the Russian culture definitely plays a role in that. And that, but the role is more, it has always been like that. It has always been like that. You know, the famous 19th century civic poet Nikolai Nekrasov, who was widely read in Soviet schools, like a realist poet, more interesting for is his politics than his poetry, really. And he wrote a long poem called «Кому на Руси жить хорошо?» – «Who lives well in Russia?» And the answer is, of course, nobody, really. So this is almost a myth. This is almost a cliché. You know, it's a cliché along the lines of the stiff upper lip. And, you know, the many iterations of that wonderful Second World War poster, keep calm and carry on, right? Stiff upper lip, keep calm and carry on. Here is the British national character. Right? And so in that sense, suffering and everything always, you know, Sod's law, everything always lands on the buttered side. That's definitely a Russian cliche. That's one thing. Passivity. I would look at two things. I would look at the political culture. So I would look at the Russian Empire as the last absolute monarchy in Europe, where serfdom was abolished in 1861 or 1862. Then at the Communist Revolution, at the Bolshevik Revolution, and at the incredible brutalization that followed, at the purges, the Gulag, and the fact that the Second World War really really played out on Soviet soil. And when I mean Soviet soil, I mean mainly Ukrainian and Belarus, and the territory of today's Belarus, because Hitler's forces, the Nazis, didn't actually get too much into what is now Russia, which Europeans love to forget. They think it's Russia that suffered, but it's actually Ukraine that suffered probably the worst, and Poland, of course, but that was not Soviet. And then the Putin years were... Then the collapse of the Soviet Union, this big thing that collapsed, and the incredible suffering and hardship of the 1990s, which to many people were not just hardship, but also humiliating, the great power and reduced to that. And then the Putin years, where it has become absolutely clear that you cannot change this regime. The really the ultimate turn towards repression and violence is probably 2011, after the protests following the rigged elections, which he would have won anyway. There was no need to rig them. But these protests, mass protests, really huge protests, had no effect and then were suppressed violently. So Russia has no tradition whatsoever of the population ever changing those who govern it by peaceful means. Unlike Ukraine, actually, Ukraine managed quite well in those 30 years. Don't think just of the Maidan, but they had elections and people actually changed. The president actually changed according to the will of the people. Belarus, Lukashenko has been there since the end of the Soviet Union. Russia, Putin has been there since 2000. So hugely different, a huge culture of whatever we do, we can't do anything anyway. And my last point here really is, if you look at the way, don't look at Moscow, don't look at St. Petersburg, but look at that vast country, look at provincial places, look at ethnic minority places like Tuva or Buryatia. These are Asian federal subjects that with borders to Mongolia, so really all in the east, where people are utterly poor, where there's a lot of violence, and where the lives of many men are characterized by the army and by prison. So these are brutal hierarchies where the one thing that you do learn is that you can't change anything, and if you stick out, you'll be cut down. And that soldier who had been in the army definitely is a product of that system as well. So I think all these factors need to be taken into account. If we want to say, why are they, I mean, I'm now generalizing, but why are so many Russian subjects so passive, even if they do not subscribe to Russian national exceptionalism? Because they do. For us, it's like this. This is our fate. We were brought up like that. We can't change.
Your piece is this sort of like wonderful kind of live dialectic between one of these big questions in history about whether, you know, events are driven by ideas, whether history happens because of ideas, or whether it's driven by material conditions. And you mention in your piece epigenetics. We know now that intergenerational trauma is literally carried down in our bodies. It might not be ingrained in our genes, but it's, you know, it's there. And there are experiments that show this, at least in other mammals, and we have no reason to believe that that's also not the case with us. How do you balance these two kind of accounts? One, thinking about the culture, the ideas, the sort of ideology that is giving people perhaps a sense of meaning or a sense of identity, and on the other hand, just the real material conditions of several generations and how those have been ingrained in people's experiences and what they expect from life. How do we balance in thinking about the influences of the two?
I man lives not by bread alone, if you allow me another biblical quote, of course. So material conditions play a role, and culture also plays a role. So human nature is composed of all those factors. I don't think it is possible to neatly differentiate between the two. So the cultural environment, what your parents think, how you experience authority, how you actually experience your sense of self, is it valued, or are your teachers always putting you down? If they are putting you down, do you have advocacy or do you have agency? All this really does matter. And on the other hand, of course, poverty matters. Poverty can brutalize. And in many regions, the army is one of the few paths open to young men to actually earn money to ever have a family. And then if you are in a culture where there is a cult of the army and where there's a cult of the war, Second World War, but also other wars, you know, the Second World War in Russia is not called the Second World War. It's called the Great Patriotic War. And it started in 1941 when Hitler attacked the Soviet Union. So all these things come together. And so if you are in an area where, I don't know, all your mates go and join the army, or where, you know, that is what you can do. And yes, you know that there is a very nasty hierarchy, and that your officers can do stuff to you with impunity and all that. Mm. All these things come together and they create this horrible passivity that we see. I must say, I have watched a couple of interviews. I'm actually both on the Russian, exiled Russian TV channel, TV Rain, Dozhd, and on various Ukrainian channels. There is a Ukrainian journalist, Vladimir Zolkin, who interviews Russian prisoners of war. And yes, one can debate whether that is ethical. He isn't threatening them. He isn't actually being nasty to them, and they seem to consent to being interviewed. And I haven't seen a single soldier saying bad or nationalistic or brutal things about Ukrainians. What I have seen is an incredible amount of ignorance about Ukraine, about the West. What one person said, well, that I thought I was going to fight Poles and Nazis. Well, did you see any Poles or any Nazis? No, I only saw Ukrainians and they were Nazis. So why do you think we invaded? Well, you know, because there is a certain element that needs to be annihilated. So here comes a TV cliche phrase. To me personally, that is quite horrifying. Mm. But I can't see much Russian high culture in there. So these things come together.
Do you think depending on the outcome of the war, there will be an influence or a transformation of this tradition of the Russian soul ideology? Whether Russia ends up retreating in some way, or whether it ends up dominating Ukraine and, you know, the West eventually retreating from its support, from its military support. Do you see this war as sizable enough, big enough to have an impact on this? Or are we talking about something that has been left virtually unchanged through, you know, two world wars, a Bolshevik revolution, much more maybe momentous events than the one we're experiencing now?
I think what we see is different iterations of something that has common roots. So I wouldn't say it's unchanged. That's one. Second, I think this war is absolutely in that sense decisive. It's certainly decisive for Europe in a way. It really depends on what happens. On the one hand, if Putin is removed, if he dies, and he will die, one of the thing of the great things of being significantly younger than Putin is that I will see how Putin dies. Whether that changes what's behind there, I'm not so sure. Because, yes, the moment you cut the head of the snake, this the present construct will collapse. But it doesn't mean that there are forces that can actually lead to a transformation. Many progressive people have fled. There is those who at the moment might threaten Putin. They're actually the hardliners in and around the government.
Even further to the right to Putin.
Even further to the right. I'm not sure how long. So it's not possible to inflict on Russia what was very justly inflicted on Germany at the end of the Second World War. Russia is too big. Russia is the second biggest nuclear power. So there will be nothing that forces Russia to capitulate in that way. That was, of course, what put an end to the German dream of dominating everybody. So I'm not entirely sure what will put an end to the Russian dream of domination. However, change in Russia has always happened after Russia lost a war. So whether you take the Afghan war, whether you take Crimean wars in 19th century, losing a war has usually been beneficial, even just on a small scale.
To bring us back to our kind of main theme of literature and the Russian soul, what's a book that you would recommend to listeners for kind of getting a grip on this a bit more and having a sense of the literary tradition and its outlook?
Right. I mean, you can. I think I will, because I have been in the best tradition of the Russian soul, I have been dualistic here. Mm-hmm. I will remain dualistic. First of all, I'd say, read the Russian classics and read them not, first of all, throw out that horrible sentimental cliche of the Russian soul, one. Then read the classics, and because they are fabulous works of art. Even if you might disagree with, I don't know, let's say Dostoevsky's ideas about the role of orthodoxy, and even if you might disagree with, I don't know, Tyutchev's conservative pronouncement, read the classics, read the 19th century classics. Mm-hmm. Then read something like this. I'm holding this up and it's in Russian, but it is a collection called Signposts, which is on the Russian, it's a collection of essays by the Russian emigres, the early 20th century Russian emigres, and you will see some of the of the main kind of points of argument where different factions had different ideas about Russia. And then I would think read something like famous Putin's People, for example, by Catherine Belton. And that has nothing to do with the Russian soul, but it is about the KGB. Mm-hmm. She's a journalist with decades of experience of working in Russia, and how the KGB networks are actually how they have come to dominate Russian politics and so on. And to stop mashing it all together in one path. There is also another book which is very easy reading, and it is meant to be easy reading, and that is Marsha Gessen's The Future is History. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And she has her own, or they have their own axe to grind. And it's not a history book. They are journalists. But it has the story of Boris Nemtsov, it has the gender story, it has the story of Dugin and how Dugin became what he is, and he is not Putin's mastermind. I think that is a conspiracy theory. So it will tell you about Russian Eurasianism in a very, very accessible but also meticulously researched way. So Catherine Belton's Putin's People and Masha Gessen's The Future is History, and then read the Russian classics. And please stop talking about the Russian soul.
Josephine von Sitzewitz, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
As always, this podcast was produced in partnership with The Philosopher, the UK's longest-running public philosophy journal, celebrating 100 years this year. To check out its latest issue and upcoming online events, visit thephilosopher1923.org. And if you enjoyed listening to this episode of The Philosopher in the News, don't forget to subscribe and give us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. The link is in the show notes. I always appreciate hearing feedback from listeners, and it also helps others find the podcast. I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher in the News. Speak again soon.